I am Wayne S. Ahol. We are gathered here in Kalamazoo, Michigan, at the home of Reverend John Brinson. The date is March 2nd, 1958. This recording is made for the purpose of supplying Americans and other people that were familiar with or heard of the original experience of Reinhold Schmidt at Kearney, Nebraska on November 5, 1957, and the various events that occurred after he reported sighting a spaceship at Kearney, Nebraska at that time. With my work in Washington, D.C., I began to investigate this situation. I had a friend at Kearney, Nebraska look into this situation. Correspondence went back and forth, and I received certain material and information to indicate that this man was telling of a true experience and that he had been subjected to very inhuman treatment because of the fact that he recorded this experience. I called the Hastings State Mental Hospital in Nebraska to try to talk with this man in person after he had been taken to the state mental hospital. I was told by the superintendent of the institution that he could not come to the telephone, that it was necessary to protect him from the public and the public from him. Now, we are going to make brief statements at this time indicating what our attitude or what information has come to our attention up to this time. And Mr. Reinhold Schmidt, who is present here and has appeared with me at several cities on a lecturing tour, Davenport, Iowa, Tipton, Iowa, Toledo, Ohio, and Kalamazoo, Michigan, will make a statement as to his experience and what has transpired from November 5th on. Also, we are going from Kalamazoo, Michigan, to Kearney, Nebraska, for a series of two lectures for March 5 and 6. They will be given at the National Guard Armory there, and appearing with us and in support of the program will be John Otto of Chicago, Illinois. I will now turn this microphone over to Reverend John Brinson.
I am John Brinson, Chairman of the Michigan Flying Saucer Federation. We have just completed a three-day meeting, which it has been our privilege here in Kalamazoo to have Wayne S. Ahol as speaker and Reinhold Schmidt tell his experience that he had at Kearney, Nebraska, and also a second experience in which he rode a short distance in a spaceship near Elm Creek, Nebraska. While they were here, as well as having a public meeting in a large auditorium in which some 250 persons had the opportunity of hearing Wayne Ahol and also Reinhold Schmidt's experience, they also appeared on TV and on radio programs. I have had the experience, my wife and I, of having Reinhold Schmidt and Major Wayne Ahol in our home, and I have every reason to believe that Reinhold Schmidt is a reliable as well as a very pleasant person, and we have enjoyed having him in our home. And I have no reason whatsoever to question but that his experience actually happened. And we here in Kalamazoo have been very interested and very pleased in having the opportunity of hearing his experience. And we appreciate very much this opportunity. Thank you.
Right, I am Bob Lowell, Robert Lowell, as Mr. Lowell introduced me. I am the tape librarian for the Kalamazoo Flying Saucer Study Club and work professionally in the field of education. I can only repeat Mr. Brinson's or Reverend Brinson's comments, so I'm not going to make any lengthy spiel as far as that's concerned. I read the newspaper accounting of Mr. Schmidt's Kearney, Nebraska experience, and then after meeting Mr. Schmidt, found out that the newspaper accounts were pretty much distorted, and the story that he relates, the experience I should say that he relates, because it is not just a story, it's, I feel, true, is certainly different and certainly a lot more logical than what appeared in the newspapers. And of course he has gone into much greater detail and has certainly cleared up a lot of, shall we say, hazy points that were in my mind. And I think now I will turn the mic over to Bill Meyer, who will introduce himself.
I am Bill Meyer, chairman of the Kalamazoo Flying Saucer Study Club. I think we've been very privileged to have Major Wayne S. Aho and Reinhold Schmidt in Kalamazoo. This has been our second public program in this city, and I think that the people
I'd say they're getting to be very receptive.
Yes, the people have becoming here in Kalamazoo more receptive to this thing. I think it has become an eye-opener. We hope to continue this type of program now in the future, and making plans for perhaps movies and other speakers to come in. I'll now turn this microphone over to Reinhold Schmidt. Thank you.
I am Reinhold Schmidt from 1715 Gate Street, Bakersfield, California. I am a grain buyer and working for a firm out of Los Angeles. I was sent to Kearney, Nebraska the latter part of October. On November the 5th, 1957, I was out investigating some grain fields. I drove 4 miles south, a mile east, inspecting a field of miles there. I turned off the highway onto a country road to be out of traffic. After inspecting the field, I drove up a little farther to a farm gate to turn around. Just before I got to the farm gate, I noticed a flash ahead of me about a quarter of a mile. I thought maybe they was blasting trees there, although I didn't hear no report. I thought I'd go up and see what it was. When I got within 100 feet or so, I sighted, I thought it was a balloon had crashed there. I got a little closer. My car stopped within 70 feet of the river bank. I got out of my car, walked up to the river bank, and approaching around a corner of some willows and tall grass, I noticed it wasn't no balloon at all. It was a large silver object sitting there on four, what I took to be four hydraulic rams. By this time I was within 30 feet of the object. Just about that time, a light had shot out of the side of the machine toward me, and I was stopped in my tracks. I couldn't move my arms nor my feet. I couldn't walk. This very instant, the door slid open. Two men came out of the ship, asked me whether I was armed. I told them I was not. They said they would have to search me anyway, which they did. They didn't take anything from me. By this time, I could start moving my arms and my legs again. I asked them what kind of machine it was or what they were doing there. They said they couldn't tell me that. And I asked them whether I could get closer to the machine and see it. They said, yes, as long as we can't leave for a few minutes anyway, you just well come in and look around. We got into the machine. From the appearance from the outside of the machine was completely, there was no portholes, no windows. Looks like you're just looking again a solid aluminum ship of some kind. When you've got inside of the machine, it is very transparent. You can look up, see the sky, you can look it down, see the grass, look through both sides and see the countryside around us. In this machine were four men and two ladies. There's one man who was with me at all times. The other man was working on an instrument panel. On the farthest end of the ship was a large desk with two ladies operating the instrument. I asked them several things about the ship, where they came from, and what they were doing here, and they said they couldn't tell me that at this time. These men were dressed in street clothes, the same as any of us Americans are here. In fact, they could be walking along the streets, and unless you had seen them before, you would never identify them. This one man spoke to me in American language with a German accent. Amongst themselves, whenever they got close to where I was standing, I could tell that they were talking in a high German language, a very good high German. This panel was, the inside of the ship. The entire ship, as we found out later on, was 100 feet long, 30 feet wide, and I guess to be 14 feet high. The inside panel, or the room where we were in, was approximately 50 feet long and 30 feet wide. There were two compartments on each end. That I didn't get in there. They refused to let me in there. But the ship, the big room where I was in, they had a panel on one side of the room, approximately 45 feet long and 5 feet high, completely covered with instruments. I was in the ship for about 30 minutes. After they got it, whatever they were doing was completed, they told this one man that had been with me all the time that they was ready for the takeoff, or they told in a high German language, "Wir sind fertig." While I was in the ship, I was looking at the instrument, see whether I could find some address where they was manufactured, but there wasn't any. There was no lettering in the ship, inside or out. The numerals on the different dials were in Roman numbers or regular numerals. On this panel, just where they were working on, it seemed like there was an invisible escalator. Whenever they'd want to go from one end of the ship to the other, they would just step back about a foot or a half a step and glide from one end to the other. I got on this same panel, but it wouldn't work with me, so they must have some contact on their shoes or something. When they got ready to leave, I stepped out of the ship, the door slid shut, and I heard a large motor start operating. Then the faster the momentum speeded up, the quieter it got. Pretty soon it took right straight up into the air. Within about 150 feet, there was a flash of light, and it disappeared completely out of sight. At that time, that certain day, it was hazy and misting, but the ceiling was at least 1,000 feet, but it disappeared about 150 feet.
I'd like to interrupt here for just a moment to clear something up. Now, in the newspaper accounting, and I think on radio around here at least, they said something about propellers whirring as the thing took off. Now, you have told us that this was not true. Would you explain more clearly that there was or was not any moving part visible as the thing took off?
There were no parts visible, but in these two compartments that I never got into, one on each end of the machine, there was a tube approximately 12 feet in diameter running straight up and down. I could just see the fan where the way it was sitting there on the east end of the machine. On top there looked like about a 10-bladed fan. And this is what I thought made the whirring noise. But there were no propellers. These fans were laying flat inside the machine in these 12-foot tubes.
In other words, they were more of an exhaust-type fan, if you think of it, in a ventilator.
Yes, I would think so. Although when it took off, there was no breeze around the ship whatsoever.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, did these people at this time make any statement or give you any message that you could convey to others if you told them this experience?
Yes, they told me. First, they told me not to be alarmed, that they intended to do me no harm, and for me to tell the people that we know they have seen this ship before, and they will see it again. And in the near future, they will know what it's all about.
Another question. When this ship began to take off, did it remain constant in color, or did you observe a change in color as it raised in altitude?
No, there was three different changes in color. The first color, when it left the ground approximately 15, 20 feet, it turned to a pitch black. It got up a little higher, changed colors again to a bluish green. The last flash was a real bright flash, and it disappeared before my eyes. They, after they had taken, just before they started taking off, they said for me not to try to start my car because it wouldn't start anyway. This is the first I knew that they had stopped my car. I got in my car and drove to Kearney, Nebraska. I didn't, kind of puzzled, didn't know just what to do. I knew part of the people would believe it, and the other half probably wouldn't. Although I had seen a lot of advertising that the Air Force wanted sky watchers and we should report any flying object that we've seen. I drove to Kearney, Nebraska, and looked for the Lutheran minister. I was going to ask him what to do, what he thought best to do. He didn't happen to be home that day, so I drove to the police department and asked for the sheriff. They said he was over to the courthouse. I went over to the courthouse, told my story to the sheriff, and he said, we will go out there and look. The sheriff and I drove out to this place, and on the way out there, the sheriff told me, he said, this is quite a coincidence. Just before noon today, he asked whether I heard the siren blow. I had heard, if I was in a hotel, I thought it was a fire, but he said someone had reported an unidentified object flying toward Kearney, a strange ship. But I never heard any more about that. We drove out to the place where the ship had been, where it had been setting, and he definitely said there was outlines of a large machine had been setting there, and we also found some oil was on the ground there. I asked him then whether we should, didn't think we should rope this off or put guards out there and call Washington or some one that had the official capacity of taking care of a deal like this. He said, well, we'll go back to Kearney and get some more of the officials and see what they say. We went back to the police department. We told our story to the chief of police, and later on the chief of police, myself, the sheriff, the city attorney, a photographer from the local paper, and the county attorney drove back out there again. They all verified my story that there had been a big machine sitting there, and I again asked them whether they shouldn't put some guards out there or rope it off. They said no, it wasn't necessary, as long as there were 6-7 of the officials here was witness enough. We drove back to town. They let me out of my hotel, and they put it on the air on TV and radio coast to coast. I was in a hotel for about 20 minutes. They shut off all programs, and this news came over the air. The telephone started ringing. Everybody was calling, wanted more information. Also at the police department, they were swamped with calls. Pretty soon they came over and asked whether I would come over and answer the telephone, help them answer the telephones there at the police department. The chief of police turned his office over to me, closed the door. There were two telephones in there. I answered these two telephones as fast as I could. The chief of police was out in the other room answering. And at 9:30 that night, the chief of police made an appointment with a local radio station. He went on the station with me for about an hour's interview over the air. He verified my story. Also, that same night at 10:30, we went on TV. He was with me on TV verifying my story. We still have the original tape recording that was made that night. Later on, we went back to the police department again. There are a lot of photographers that flew in, and the police department was completely swamped with photographers and news
people and telephone calls. This went on for approximately 18 hours. The Air Force from Colorado Springs flew out. They asked me the same question. I repeated, and they made a tape recording of it. And they went back to Colorado Springs. Shortly after that is when everybody wanted to change their story. The chief of police, the sheriff, the county attorney, and some more told me that they didn't think that this story was true, that they was going to change their story and wanted me to change it too. I told them no. I said, I seen this ship just the way I had it. I explained it several different times, and it was a true story, and I was going to stick with it. They had several different remarks to make. They said that they had heard that I smoked marijuana in several different deals like that. Next morning, about 5 o'clock, they asked whether I would take a lie detector test. I had been talking for about 18, 20 hours. My voice was getting very hoarse. I had a headache and I had nothing to eat all day. And I said, no, I would not go tonight anymore, but after a few hours rest, I would go to Grand Island, Nebraska and have a lie detector test. Next morning, they came out the paper that I refused to have a lie detector test. I did refuse it that night because I couldn't talk anyway, and I didn't think that was the time to go. The next morning, I asked them whether they want to go and take a lie detector test, and they said no, it wasn't necessary. The following morning, at about 10 o'clock, they brought an oil can to the jail where I had stayed all night, and they said that I just well changed my story now because they found evidence of some oil. The oil had been poured on the ground, and they found a new can of oil lying there where the ship had been sitting. The night before, the Air Force, myself, all officials, and besides from 500 to 1,000 persons had walked up and down that river where this machine had been sitting. Nobody had found an oil can there that evening. The next morning after got light here, they laid a new oil can right in plain sight where the ship had been sitting. I told them they'd have to drum up a different story than that because there sure couldn't have been that many people flying to see that oil can the night before. And I said, if you think I had anything to do with the oil can, they should take some fingerprints off it, but they didn't do that. They said they found this oil can in the back of my car. I told them I had two cans of oil in the back of my car with rice, but it wasn't the kind of cans that they were showing me. I had also a can opener in my car that would open a triangular hole. This can was opened with a round can opener. After I got back to my car again, I'd seen where they had poured oil in the back of my car over some of my laundry, and the two cans of oil that I had in my car were still there. They wanted to give me a test or go to the mental hospital. I'd seen what they was trying to do, so I just went right along with them. I didn't fight them. After they kept me in jail for 3 days, I was admitted to the mental hospital at Hastings, Nebraska. I stayed there for 2 weeks.
Now, before we go farther, I have a few questions that I would like to ask at this time. When you were on this ship originally, how did you feel about the possibility of getting off of the ship again? Did you think that you were going to ever get off again?
No, I didn't think I'd ever get out of that ship. I was very much pleased and relieved when they told me I should leave.
Did you experience any fear during that experience?
Not so much then as I did after I left for Kearney, Nebraska. I was quite scared then, after it all over with.
Now, what about this oil that was on the ground originally? Did anyone collect any of this oil and send any of it for evaluation, for examination, and where was it sent?
It was sent to, the sheriff and I picked it up in a little bottle. It was sent to the university at Lincoln, Nebraska for analysis.
Do you believe that this oil was from the spaceship, or is there any way to determine whether the oil might have come from some other source?
No, I couldn't say whether it came from the spaceship, although this oil was a greenish color and a very sweet-smelling oil. And the chief of police, myself, got some on our hands when we were picking it up off the leaves there, and we both mentioned it after we were on TV that we could still smell that oil on our fingers. It was a very sweet-smelling oil of a greenish color. Whether it came out of the ship, I wouldn't say because I don't never seen where it came out of.
Did the news photographer that was with you and the official photograph any of the marks that were in the sand where the ship had been resting?
Yes, the local newspaper photographed the four different places where the ship had been resting, especially one of the imprints in the sand was about 2 to 3 inches deep. It was very, very plain. The other three weren't so plain.
About what was the diameter of these marks in the sand?
They were approximately a foot in diameter, round.
Were any footprints visible where people had just walked?
Yes, there was a footprint visible. The chief of police, when he explained it over the TV and over the radio, he said he could see where the... I had gotten out of the car. There's two tracks that come met me, and the three of us had walked back to the ship, and it looked like we had been yanked upwards because all three steps, footprints stopped at the same time. That's when we stepped on a step, I guess, and walked into the ship.
Now, you made some statements that you were accused of smoking marijuana. Do you smoke at all?
I do not smoke at all, no, sir.
Who had the keys to your car while you were being held in the jail? How were people, or how was anyone able to get into your car while you were in being held there?
The chief of police, when they put me in jail, took all belongings I had with me and had them in his possession, including the car keys.
Was any warrant signed for your arrest, or were you held legally by this sheriff's department?
There was no warrant signed. I asked them what they would hold me for, and they said they were just going to hold me. There was no warrant signed or anything. I asked them to use the telephone. They refused to let me use the telephone. They let me use the telephone once to call some local attorney there, but I didn't. After I seen who he was, he happened to be the assistant county attorney, and I didn't want him. They wouldn't let me call my brother. They wouldn't let me call my employer in California, and they would not let me have no counsel of any kind.
Now, I read in some material from the Nebraska newspaper, the Public Pulse, where your wife reported certain incidents that authorities had called her and told her certain things. Would you recount what this situation was about it being a suicide risk?
Yes, they called my wife at Casper, Wyoming, and they told her the deal. Although she had read about it in the papers, they told her that for her to call the boys and bring a lawyer and come and take me to the mental institution, that they had no facility to hold me there. I was a suicidal risk. They told her that they would have to take me there that night. She said she would call the boys and would call right back. This approximately an hour elapsed in between times. She called back and said not to take me to the hospital. They would fly over and be there at least 10 or 11 o'clock that night. They told her it was too late for her not to even come for at least 2 weeks because they had taken me to the hospital at 9:30, which was not true. I didn't leave the hospital. I didn't leave for the hospital until 11:30 that night.
Did these officials treat you as a suicide risk while you were being held in the jail?
I didn't know anything about it that they had told this story until after I talked to some of them.
Were any of your possessions taken away from you that would have been dangerous?
Yes, they told the public that they had to take my shoestrings, my belt, and my necktie away from me. But this was not true because I still had it. I even had a razor in the cell where I was at.
What happened with your brothers? Did anyone call your brothers, and what did they relate about their experience?
They called my brothers, one brother at Grand Island, Nebraska, and one brother at Hastings, Nebraska. They also called my sister at Kennesaw, Nebraska. They told them the same thing, that I was suicidal risk, for them to get their lawyer and their sheriff to come and get me and commit me to the hospital at Hastings, Nebraska. As luck would have it, I was with my brother on a Sunday before, just 2 days before this, and we had a family reunion there. They thought that was kind of funny that something should happen to me that fast, although they did go talk to the lawyers. Their lawyers advised them different because their lawyers told them they had watched this case all the way through, and that it just had gotten too big for the county officials, and they wanted to get rid of me, and if they would go get me, their hands were washed of the whole thing. But my brother called them up and told them that they would not come and get me.
Now, before you went to the Hastings State Mental Hospital, was any medical examination or any mental examination given you to determine whether or not you should go to this hospital? Who participated in this examination, and where was it held?
This examination took place above the fire department, back of locked doors, and they consisted of the chief of police, the sheriff, the county attorney. They introduced themselves as another attorney there, and the clerk of the district court. There was no doctor there. We had been there for at least 30 minutes just talking. Finally, this doctor did come. He asked me three questions. He asked me how I felt about the people of Kearney, whether I still maintained I'd seen the ship, and whether I was willing to go to the hospital for treatment. That's the only three questions this doctor asked me.
What was your reply to the question of whether you wanted to go to the hospital or not?
I said, no, I was not going on my own free will. If they wanted to take me there, they'd have to take
me. Did anyone there in Kearney try to find where this medical or this mental examination was being held?
Yes. Mr. Gene Larson, the manager of the KGSW in Kearney, Nebraska, told me that he looked all afternoon. He knew this meeting was taking place, and he looked for the meeting where it was at. He finally found it through some of policemen had told him where it was at. When he got there, he was all alone.
Now, the newspaper accounts recounted the two psychiatrists, and it mentioned them by name, and the news report was that these two psychiatrists said that you told your story the same way each time, therefore you have a fixation and you have to have immediate mental treatment. Did you meet these psychiatrists, and did they question you before you were sent to the hospital?
Yes, I talked to these two psychiatrists in the same room above the fire department in Kearney, Nebraska, for about 20 minutes.
What kind of questions did they ask you, and what transpired? Did they ask you questions? Did they both participate in the examination? Would you relate that, please?
No, sir. One of the psychiatrists, he never said a word. He never introduced himself. When he came there, he was just sitting there holding his hand over his face and looking down on the floor. He never asked you no questions. The other one done the talking.
What kind of questions did he ask you?
He asked, I don't remember just all of them, but just concerning one thing or another about the spaceship. And he also asked me, he said, one question he asked me, he said, who was the smartest, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln? I told him I wasn't born then, yet I wouldn't know. Another question he asked me was, if I wasn't a human being, what would I sooner be? I told him I'd sooner be a psychiatrist. And then several others I don't just remember.
What was his reaction when you told him that you'd rather be a psychiatrist if you couldn't be a human being?
He was quite put out about I think that's about the last question he asked.
That was about the time he quit.
Yes.
Would you have a question?
Yes, I was going to ask you, did you feel that because of the change of circumstances in the investigation and the apparent actions here on the part of the Air Force, did you feel that this was a deliberate attempt on the part of the Air Force or any branch of the Security Commission to completely squelch this story to the extent that the public would have no honest understanding of it?
That's right. I wouldn't say the Air Force done it. I don't know who done it, but right into the Air Force was there. They all changed their stories and wanted me to change mine.
In other words, it did look as if there was a deliberate attempt to completely squelch it.
Yes.
What methods did they use on you to try to get you to change your story?
Just talking is all.
I mean, did they threaten you or make you any offers?
No, they never threatened me. One man asked me, he said, how much money would you take to change your story? And I said the national debt wasn't big enough to make me change my story.
Would you go ahead and recount then what happened at the hospital? But do you know actually who committed you to this state mental hospital? Who brought it about or ordered this commitment?
I never seen the commission papers, but I heard later on that the county attorney, the chief of police, and the sheriff signed the complaint.
I have one question here. At the examination above the fire department there, did you feel that this was a deliberate attempt to determine an evaluation of your sanity without the aid of professional medical advice? You mentioned that someone was trying to get in contact with you at the time this meeting was going on, but it was not made clear, to me at least, who this individual was and what the purpose of his contact or his attempt to locate you was. Who was this individual?
His name was Gene Larson, the manager of KGSW, the local radio station there. He wanted to come up there for news purposes, and he had been helping me all the way through as much as he could. He wanted to sit in on this meeting, but he never got there.
Do you think that at this meeting, the medical doctor, if there was one there, do you think that he was contacted by any officials previously?
Yes. He had his report made out before he ever asked me any questions. I've seen it all laying there.
I see. Who was this doctor?
He introduced himself, but I forgot his name.
I see. He was a medical doctor as such in private practice, or was he a psychiatrist?
No, he said he was a medical doctor, but I forgot his name.
I see.
Do you know where he was from?
No, sir.
Now, regarding the developments just preceding this, were you able to engage counsel for yourself or get any kind of assistance in the way of legal counsel?
No, sir. I asked to use the telephone to call my boss in California or call my brothers. I knew they would, any of them would brought an attorney over. I was not acquainted in Kearney, Nebraska, and I didn't know any attorneys to call there.
Was any counsel offered to you?
Yeah, there was a counsel. He said, well, we have a lot of attorneys here, and he did get the telephone book, and he run his finger down, and he said, well, here's a good one. His name happened to be Myers, I think it was. And he did call him. Minor was his name, Warren Minor. And he did call him, and when he got there, I remembered seeing him for some reason or other. He was in a hotel there, and somebody had told me he was assistant county attorney, which wouldn't have done me no good at all. And I talked to him. After I seen him, I talked to him. He said, well, you should change your plea and tell him you never seen his story. I talked to him about 3 minutes, and I told him I couldn't use him. And that's the last I ever had a counsel until it
later. Was there any jury trial or any anything of that nature to determine whether you should go to the state hospital?
There was not.
Would you go ahead and relate them what happened at the hospital?
At the hospital, I was admitted to the hospital at 11:30 that night. The next morning at 10 o'clock, I was called before the doctors, at panel, what they call it. There was about 20, 30 doctors there. And they told me, I was all sitting around the room, they told me that they were going to ask me some questions, and I should feel free to ask them any questions. They asked me questions for about 20 minutes. I didn't ask them any questions. And they excused me, told me to go set the recreation hall and watch TV. And in several hours, the doctor that is consigned to my case came out, and he wanted to know what I was in there for. I told him I didn't know, it wasn't my idea. And he kind of shook his head and walked away. 3 days later, they've gotten a lot of the test bags, 3 or 4 days later. They got a lot of the tests back, and he said that I had passed them all they've taken so far, and they couldn't find nothing wrong with me. They even called, by mistake, they got a hold of the KGSW, Mr. Larson's And they told him, they gave him a bad time. They said, what in the world did you send this man up here for? And Mr. Larson told us he was just a news reporter. He should call the police department. They're the ones that done it. He called the police department. I don't know what they told him. After 4 days, the test they had given me, they said I had passed them all. And they said they could release me. I said, no, I owe it to myself and the public. I won every test available that they knew in this hospital. And the doctor said, well, that was a very wise move to do that. They gave me all the tests that they knew available. And that lasted about 2 weeks when they finally got all the tests back again.
Do you know if anyone tried to reach you while you were at the hospital? Did you receive any mail or any communication while you were in this hospital?
I received some mail from immediate family. That's the only mail I received. I got a couple letters from the boys. My boss in California had a fortunate person call in for 3 days. He never did get to talk to me. Also, several others, as far as my business concerned, tried to call me, and they never could get in contact with me. They wouldn't let nobody into this with me, just the immediate family. I couldn't call out, or let, and nobody could call in.
What were the circumstances surrounding your final release from the hospital?
The last day, when all the tests were back, I was in the just came out of the panel again, been before the doctors, and in fact, a couple of days before that, they told me that I had passed all the tests that they would release me. When I came out of from the panel the second time, my employer from Raleigh, California, had came to Hastings, Nebraska, and he walked in the hospital. I introduced him to my doctor, and he asked him what they had found. They said there's nothing wrong with me, although according to law, they could hold me for 2 more days. My employer was very much put out about it because they would hold me there, and he could have used me in his business, what he sent me to Nebraska to do. He was very much put out. He told them if there was nothing wrong with me, that they should release me tonight. Otherwise, tomorrow he would fly his fleet of lawyers down from California, and there would be a lot of trouble. I was... This doctor went into the other room for about 5 minutes. He came back out, and I was released within 5 minutes. I never even... They said they would mail me the release papers, which they did.
Now, during this time that you were held in this hospital, did you suffer any financial loss?
Yes. A year ago, I was buying grain at Wilcox, Arizona. They were short of combine there, corn combine. And we needed some corn. I bought 3 Minneapolis Moline picker shellers. They cost $4,200 a piece, which amounted quite a bit over $13,000. I had very good luck with them the first year. They were all paid off except $1,300.
We paused momentarily there in our recording for one of the gentlemen to change the tapes on his machine. And we will continue now, uninterrupted as before.
The implement company where I had bought these machines from knew I was in a hospital and probably wouldn't get out for a year or two. He repossessed these machines. The foreman disappeared. I have wrote him several different letters since that time. All the letters come back. I have never been able to find him. He has never sent me no money. So it was quite a loss, at least $15,000, $16,000. I went back to buying grain at Kearney, Nebraska, right after I got out of the hospital. I had very good luck. All the farmers were for me 100%. In fact, I could buy more grain than I could handle. A lot of the farmers asked me what I was going to do about the police department and the sheriff's department where they had treated me. At that time, I hadn't thought much about it. They said, well, if you don't do something about it, we think you are crazy. I was about a month or two later, or be exact, the fifth day of
February 1958. I was out in the country inspecting some grain or driving around. My car stopped south of Elm Creek, Nebraska. When my car stopped, about this very instant, this same ship again hovered down on the inside of the fence about 30 feet from me on a prairie. I knew the ship when I seen it, the same one I had seen before. I got out of the car and walked toward the ship. The men, one man came to the door and asked whether I had a little time, whether I would care to talk to them. They had a favor they would like to ask. I got into the ship and they said, we can't stop right here beside the country road. It caused too much confusion, whether I would mind if we would take a little ride a short distance. I said, no, I'd be glad to do that. We got up and raised up and flew over about 2 miles and settled again down in the river among the trees. This ship, I forgot to mention it the first time, was completely transparent. You could look up and see the sky, you could look down and see the grass, or you could look sideways and see the whole countryside. But from the outside, it's just a complete aluminum balloon or something.
Mr. Smith, I'd like to ask you a question here at this point. The first time that you were contacted and you talked to the individuals within the ship, apparently they were able to communicate to you in an intelligible language, and apparently they were able to do so on the second contact, and apparently they had a method of knowing where you were. And now this infers some method of telepathic communication. Do you feel that they are able to understand our thoughts and consequently interpret our thoughts into intelligible language, quickly learn the language, and adapt themselves to the conditions? In other words, I want you here to answer in your own way how it was possible that they could speak to you either in English or in High German or in any language.
I don't know how many languages they can speak, but they talk to me in American language with a German accent. On a second visit, I asked them how they knew I was along this country or how they were able to pick me up. And he kind of smiled. He said, these are the very words he used. He said, we have your brain impulses and we can pick you up any place. I asked him, I said, well, I'm going to maybe go to California in a short while. He said it didn't make any difference. They could pick me up there. He said, you folks here have your fingerprints where you identify people. We use the brain impulses. And I knew they could do that because otherwise I was alone in the car and I don't know how else they could have picked me up. I believe just what they told me. We flew over to the river there. On the way over there, I asked them what propelled this machine or what kind of gas they used. And they said, we do not use any gas. We get the energy from the earth and from the sun. We landed down on the river bed there again, and these are the questions that they asked me, and I told them I would try and find out. The first question was, what would the United States do if other planets were to start Sputniks or satellites orbiting the Earth, interrupting all TV, radio, and a lot of other devices, also the atomic bomb? It seems to me, after that first question, when they told me that, it seems to me that's definitely made me believe that they were from out of space, and was wondering if somebody from out of space would shoot atomic bombs down to us or have satellites orbiting this Earth, what we would do. Also, the second question was, what was this ship carrying that disintegrated over the Pacific Ocean? We found out later on it happened to be on November the 8th, 1957. They wanted to know what this ship was carrying besides the passengers. I told them it wasn't a military secret. I would try and find out and let them know. The third question would be, how would the people react if a fleet of these ships would land and talk to all people on a friendly mission? Would they accept us on friendly terms?
here lately on the several different meetings where I was at, all people seemed to cooperate very nicely and said they would accept them in friendly terms and would be glad to talk to them. I talked to a sheriff in Nebraska. I told him the same thing, and he said he would turn his machine gun loose on them. I told him his machine gun probably wouldn't last any longer than just a little bean shooter beside their machine. But that's about, they took me back, set me down beside my car again, and said they would meet me or contact me in the near future. I asked them whether they would give me their address. I'd be glad to write them a letter, but they said they would contact me. That's about the experience that I had in this two contacts with these flying objects.
I have a question, Mr. Schmidt. In your first experience, do you know whether there were any other witnesses that observed this craft at any time before or after your experience or during your experience?
At the time this, I had the trouble up there in Kearney, I didn't know that there wasn't any other witnesses. I'm sure that some of them have seen it. The county attorney told me that he had talked to some farmers there and their tractor had stopped. But as I come out of the hospital, I found out that there was two prominent businessmen from Kearney, Nebraska, after they had sent me to the hospital at Hastings, Nebraska. They called Mr. Larson at the KGSW and told him that they had a statement they would like to make, but first they wanted him to find out whether there were any jets in that territory that certain day. He said he could find that out. He called Cheyenne, Wyoming, and he called the Eastern Radar Station, which happened to be Lincoln, I believe. They, in an hour, Mr. Larson told me they called back and said there were no jets in that territory or no Army planes in that territory at all that afternoon. So he revealed this information to these two businessmen. They came up to the radio station and made a tape recording that they were hunting pheasants up there this same afternoon between 2 and 3 o'clock when I was with this ship. They said they'd seen this ship. They heard it. They seen me drive up to the ship or walk up to the ship. They made this tape recording. They took it over to the police station and played it to the police department and told them they'd better get me out of the hospital because they had two witnesses, reliable witnesses. But this was never brought out. This tape is locked in a safe at KGSW in Kearney, Nebraska, and it can be subpoenaed about the only way you can get it. These people don't like to be get on a public appearance or anything like that, although they said if it helped me in any way, that they would be glad to let me subpoena the tape. Also, a friend of mine in Kearney, Nebraska, said that he talked to three farmers that were hunting ducks that afternoon on a river there, were sitting in the blind. They seen this ship. They seen me walk into the ship and leave again. They are family men, and they said that they didn't want to get mixed up with it because they didn't have no time to take a mental test. Just before I came to Davenport, Nebraska, a couple of days before that, a friend of mine at Kennesaw, Nebraska, told me that the Lewis Construction Company, the entire crew had seen that ship. I don't even know the Lewis Construction Company, but they volunteered to tell it. The entire crew seen this ship shortly after noon that same day. This Lewis Construction Company is a land leveling outfit. They probably have 15, 20 men working there. Whether they all seen it, I don't know.
You mentioned Davenport, Nebraska. You meant Davenport, Iowa.
Davenport, Iowa, yes.
Now, I tried to call you at the Hastings Hospital from Washington, D.C. Were you informed that anyone had tried to call you?
I was not.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you only received mail from near relatives. Were you ever able to receive any other mail that had been sent to you during the time that you were in the hospital? What happened to any mail that was sent to you?
The only mail I got in the hospital was just from immediate relatives. The doctor told me there that when I was released that I had a lot of mail at the police department in Kearney, Nebraska. Also, Gene Larson told me the same thing, that the manager of the KGFW.
Mr. Schmidt, I'd like to ask you a question here. Relative to both your first and your second experience, and that regards the nature of the occupants of this craft. I'd like to ask you the general height, the appearance of the occupants, the color of the skin, the type of clothing. In other words, was there an almost identical resemblance here to what we consider to be human form, or were there some differences?
These men, as near as I can gauge them, they were about 5'6" tall, weighed 160-170 pounds. They were of a dark complexion. One of them had a little mustache. The two ladies were weighed about 130. They were brunettes. They had light colored waists, dark skirts, and low heeled shoes. This one girl had a very small earring. I am sure this one, and they were all of a dark complexion. I am sure this one man that was with me practically all the time in his ship, or was with me all the time in his ship, he was in a Fort Kearney hotel watching TV the night before. I talked to him. He didn't say much, but he had the very same German accent that they talked to me in the ship. He didn't talk too much to me or to the other men, but there was a little boy there that he talked to quite a bit, and I could tell by his talk, it sounded just exactly like the men that were in the ship. I told this to the officials of Kearney, Nebraska, and they said they investigated that this man was from Chicago.
I'd like to ask you one other question here. What type of clothing, specifically, did the gentleman wear? In other words, what color was it? Was it a one-piece garment, two-piece, shirt, trousers as we wear, or, in other words, precisely, what was it?
They had a business suit on. They had a coat, a shirt. They were an all-white shirt. Some of them were striped shirts and trousers. They could walk any place on the streets in any town. Unless you had seen them before, you would never identify them as being on that ship. I would know them because I have seen them several different times.
Now, Mr. Smith, coming back to this mail situation, did you receive or find your mail that you were told was at the sheriff's office in Kearney, Nebraska?
No. When I came back out of the hospital, I went to the police department and asked for a mail, and they said they had no mail there. All the mail that they had given to the county attorney. I asked the attorney, and he said he had received no mail. There was quite a bunch of mail, although I have never seen it. That was delivered to the police department that has been told to me by several people. One of them, Gene Larson, the manager of the KGFW, told me there was quite a stack of mail, but I never did receive it. I was told that this mail was there, but I never did receive it. I was even told that they had seen some money in this envelope. I never received any money from anybody. I put an ad in the paper that's addressed in the public pulse to the public. Anybody that had written letters to me, and I had to acknowledge them, especially if there was money in it, they should write to me again, because some of my mail had been lost, and I had not received it. This has never been printed. They refused to print this, or they never said they refused to print it, but it never was printed.
Mr. Smith, what is the name of your employer in California? What is the name of the firm you work for?
I bought for the Value Pack at Brawley, California. The manager there was Don Waddell. I also bought for the Balfour & Guthrie and Company Limited. That's an English outfit. But they didn't draw no grain out of Nebraska. When I get back to California, they buy grain out. But Nebraska don't draw no grain out. It's the Value Pack.
Did Balfour & Guthrie do anything to assist you or check into this matter while you were in the hospital?
Yes, they did. They sent. They talked to me several different times. They also sent a long letter in form of an affidavit to the hospital stating that I had bought millions and millions of pounds of grain for them, handled millions of dollars for them, and they had found me very reliable and never had a mistake. The other employer, Mr. Waddell, with the Value Pack, flew to Hastings, Nebraska from California and assisted me on getting out of the hospital.
Did you receive any telephone calls from Balfour & Guthrie while you were in the hospital?
No.
Now, what happened when you were released from the hospital and you talked with your employer from Raleigh, California? What was his attitude toward re-employing you again?
If we got back to Kearney, Nebraska, we had breakfast there this following morning. And I said, well, said, am I still working for you, or will I have to look for another job? And he said, you absolutely are working for us. The manager of the KGSW was there with us, and he said that he thought it would be a good idea if I'd give Kearney a wide berth, and that's Bob there. My boss spoke up and he said, Smitty hasn't done anything wrong, and we're going to leave him right here and let him start buying just where he left off, which I did. I had more grain than I could handle, probably. Every farmer was for me 100%.
Did you do some advertising that you were back in business?
Yes, I put an ad in a paper with the help of my employer, and this is the way it read. It says, attention, Milo and corn growers. A crazy grain buyer from California is still around and would like to put a bid on your grain. When this paper hit the streets at 4 o'clock, the telephones were all swamped at the hotel again. People calling me and wanted to sell me grain.
Now, what happened? Did someone report to you at the attitude or the activity of the public or high school students in particular while you were in the hospital?
Yes, Gene Larson with the KGSW, when I come back, he told me that the high school student at Kearney, Nebraska was really for me 100%. He said they almost swamped the police department for 3 days. That he told them that here we're teaching us to be good citizens, and you, a perfect stranger comes to your town and you treat him the way you did Mr. Schmidt. He said that was unconstitutional. They were very much put out about the high school colleges of Kearney, Nebraska.
Now, in the newspaper accounts that came out shortly after this experience was reported, about the second day, the press, the radio, and TV programs began to call you the ex-convict from Nebraska. I noticed in particular that they never mentioned your name as Reinhold Schmidt. They merely said that the ex-convict from Nebraska. What was the background or the reason for this statement about him being an ex-convict?
About 30 years ago, I was buying vegetables for a potato firm that was located in Hastings, Nebraska. I had bought for them 1 year. The second year, this company went broke. I was authorized to write checks on this company, me and another buyer. The second year this company went broke, I had about 6 checks out. When I found out that he was getting short of money, I went around and helped the farmers. When I knew there's money in the bank, I could hear the conversation there. I would go tell them to get their checks in and get their money. I helped them all get their money except 2 checks. These 2 checks with my name on never did clear. Also, the other buyer had about 6 checks out. They didn't clear. And the boss himself had quite a few checked out.
What happened as a result of this?
They had a trial, and we were all convicted as, they called mine embezzlement. They said that it came out in a trial if we were all together and we worked this scheme together. I went to Lincoln, Nebraska, had my fingerprints taken, and was sent to Genoa to the state farm for 6 months. I was a trustee there right away. From the next day right away, they signed me to a grocery truck, and I hauled groceries from out of town back to the Genoa farm.
Did you have any letters or any official authority from this firm authorizing you to sign checks for them?
Yes, I had a letter that same as I have now from these wheat companies, authorized me to sign checks.
But regardless of this fact, why they convicted you or claimed that you were a party?
Yes, I was a party, not myself, but also the other buyer.
But the firm, what happened was that the firm went broke?
Yes, the firm went broke, and as a consequence, some of the farmers did lose some money.
But you were not a member of the firm.
No, sir. I was just a paid buyer.
There were some other reports in my own investigation at Kearney, Nebraska. It was reported from Kearney. And I understand that others also had this report given to them. Something to the effect that that you had been robbed and that some money that belonged to some firm had been taken from you, but there was some question as to the real circumstances. What was that? What was this situation about a robbery?
This robbery took place in close to Cedar City, Utah. I was going from Nebraska to California to buy potatoes there on my own. I went to the bank the night before, and I didn't want to keep the money out of the bank that night. I went to my bank and talked to him. He said, "Will you come in before 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and I'll have the money out so I can give it to you." He opened the bank early that next morning. He gave me $14,000 in cash. I put it in my money belt and went to California. Going through Utah, I don't know if any of you had heard about this, but they called them the red light bandits. They would flash a red light in your face and stop you. Rob. They always watch first whether there's more than one person in the car. The night before, they robbed the sheriff of Cedar City, Utah. They robbed him. He was alone in the car. This night, I was driving through Cedar City, Utah, through the hills where there, this light flashed in my face. I thought it was a patrol there, and there was a wreck there. I stopped when I seen that it was a little foreign car, and I figured then maybe they'd out of gas. I stepped on the accelerator and was going to go on by them, and they shot my lights out. They stopped. I had to get out, and they searched me and took my wallet away from me. I had a heavy coat on. Some way or other, he happened to see whether I had a money belt. He noticed the money belt. I had all this money in there, and I didn't think I wanted to give that up without a struggle. So I hit him on the jaw and knocked his gun out of his hand. But this other man who was with him was standing on the other side of me. He shot me through the arm. The coat I had upstairs took out the bullet hole. And, of course, then I give up. They took me. This happened to be south of Cedar City on the highway. But before they robbed me, they took me on a little off road there and searched me. They shot a hypodermic needle through into my arm and said, "We'll put you to sleep so you can't report this right away." But the heavy coat I had on, it didn't take effect. I went back to the hospital. I managed to stay awake. I went back to report to the police at Cedar City, Utah. He put me in a hospital. He said they might have got some air in my blood veins and they wanted to watch me. I remember the nurses sat there all night long and kept me awake because they wouldn't let me go to sleep, but they thought I'd never wake up. I stayed there all that night. The next morning, I was released from the hospital and went on my way. This money was my own money. There was nobody else's money involved. This was my own money. I got they caught these red light bandits about a year later, and they admitted that they did get $14,000 from a, at that time, out of Nebraska car. From a Nebraska man.
What was the year when this happened?
That was, that has been about, I don't remember the year without looking it up. It has been at least 10 years ago.
What was the situation about potatoes? Someone seemed to tie some potatoes into a situation.
Same person that told about me using marijuana told, the sheriff there in Kearney that I had, he knew of a time that I had taken a truckload of potatoes to Kearney, Nebraska, had sold them, and got $10,000 for them. The KGFW, Mr. Larson, looked up the year. He said that I had gotten these potatoes. He looked up. The potatoes at that time were worth 50 cents a hundred. And he said it had taken a train load to have $10,000. Never was such a thing as... And I never did haul any potatoes to Kearney or any other place far they could take.
Now, I was wondering about about some of your background. Prior to this employment by Balfour and Guthrie and the Value Pack Company, what city and what state were you born in?
I was born in Kennesaw, Nebraska, just about 18 miles west or east of Kearney, where this all took place. I was on my father's farm there for 18 years. After he passed away, my mother stayed with me. I farmed the farm for 18 years. The depression hit, and shortly after that depression, I started working for other people. I never did sell. I've been buying from different firms all the time. At the first, I bought for the potato company, the one I had trouble with. The second, when I come back to work, I had two offers to go back to buy again, right in the same town. One of them was for the Severs Potato Company. I bought for him for 5 years. Then I bought for the Farmers Union in Ogden, Utah. I bought livestock out of Ron Kearney.
I'd like to ask a question here, Mr. Smith. Would you give us some idea of your education? I know that you apparently do understand German. How did you acquire that? And something about your education.
I went to the country school, a grade school, at Kennesaw, Nebraska. I graduated from the eighth grade. I went to the parochial school, took three terms of the German language, reading, writing, and so forth. I graduated from that. I went to the high school for 1 year in Kennesaw, Nebraska, and then I went for 1 year to the normal in Kearney, Nebraska, as wireless telegraphy. And I didn't finish there because I was drafted to go to the Army. But then, if you remember, the flu was so bad there last fall where I was called three times but never get there. And then the war was over. I started buying it when I got through buying for the Farmers Union in Ogden, Utah. I went to Bakersfield and was growing deal there, and I bought for the city produce in Los Angeles. Also, they had a growing deal in Mexico. They sent me to old Mexico to get the vegetables across the line. I was with them for 3 years on a growing deal and a joint deal.
Mr. Schmidt, what activity or what work did you do during the war years?
During the war years, I was at Sidney, Nebraska, when they put that ammunition depot in there. I was the third man the government hired there, and I was dispatcher for the government. I stayed with them from the time they started that plant until they closed it. I was with them for about 2 years as dispatcher for the government.
What did the dispatcher do?
I carried secret papers from one place. I don't know what kind of papers it was, but they'd give me sealed orders, and I would take them to different towns and wait for an answer.
Now, regarding this ship and this visitation and your present work, how does it happen that you are accompanying me on your lecture tour? Is this with the knowledge and consent of your employer?
Yes. Both of my employers are very much interested in this deal. They didn't like the way I was treated, and they gave me a temporary leave. They said any time I was through to come back and go to work for them. If it takes 1 week or a year, it didn't make a difference.
Now, after you were released from the hospital, I have noticed that there in Washington, we did not receive any news to the effect from the newspapers or any other means of communication that you had actually been released from the hospital, and there was great question at times as to whether you were in the hospital or where you were. What happened after you were released from the hospital, and were you able to get any kind of nationwide news release or any nationwide publicity to inform the people of America that you were released from the hospital and that you had passed your test?
I had my car stored at Kearney, Nebraska in a Buick garage there. I came from Hastings, Nebraska to Kearney on a bus. Mr. Gene Larson, the manager of the KGFW, met me at the bus. He found out through my employer that I was coming. And he met me there, and he said the least he thought he owed it to me to put me on the tape again and broadcast and national, nationwide again. I sat up there and just made a tape recording for about an hour and a half, telling my some of the highlights happened in the hospital. And he said he would release that on the network the next morning. Whether he did or not, I never did hear it. Nobody else ever heard it. The paper did come out, not the paper, a little memogram come out like this, scattered around Carney on the desk in a cafe and stuff. The little place on top, Harold Schmidt Religion Hospital, that's all what I ever seen. They, although my doctor from that was consigned to my case at Hastings, Nebraska, I heard him four different times on my car radio while I was driving, that he said I had been released, passed all the tests, and they had no reason to hold me, and I went back to Kearney, Nebraska with fine grain again. I heard that four times myself, the doctor.
Were you contacted by any wire service or anyone after you were released from the hospital with the idea of giving you a news release stating that you were out of the hospital?
No, I was not. About 2 weeks later, the United Press came to me in the hotel and said that he had been working on it all the time, but whether he put that out, released that I was released from the hospital, I really don't know. I never asked him. I never paid my attention.
Mr. Smith, I want to ask you a question here now in regard to this experience. Have you read any literature on the subject of flying saucers or unidentified flying objects, as they are called? Have you read, let us say, such books by George Adamski, George Van Tassel, some of the other writers in the field who purportedly have had authentic experiences?
No, sir, I have not. I haven't. I never was a disbeliever in this spaceship, and I never believed them, but up to this day, I have never read a book.
In other words, you couldn't have been acquainted with any material of this type previous to your experience?
No, sir, I didn't. I hadn't had no experience with them, and I never read no books or any literature of any kind. In fact, I never, and nobody has ever sat down and explained it to me, even.
I have several questions here in relation to the ship that perhaps people would be interested in. Do you have an accurate drawing of the ship made?
Yes, I had two of them made. One of them was made by an artist in Kearney, Nebraska, and was sent over TV. Another one was made at Kalamazoo, Michigan, by an artist. Designed, as I've seen it, and he drew it, which is on hand built now.
Could you tell me some of the physical nature of this craft? For instance, the door. How is this door located in the side of the ship? Could you easily see it?
No, you couldn't see this door at all when it was closed. When it was open, it slid to the inside and into the frame of the ship. It didn't open up to the inside. It just kind of dropped in about a foot and then slid into the wall. At the same time, the steps would come out from the bottom of the ship some way up to the ground, about four steps.
Did you have any indication as to the thickness of the walls of the craft?
Not for sure, just where we walked through the door there, the walls were about a foot thick there. And it looked like the wall where you're looking through this glass, looked like there was a double glass there, and it was about a foot thick there.
And these hydraulic landing gear, did they retract into the body of the ship? Did you notice?
Yes. When it was up in the air, the first time I noticed they disappeared. I never seen them retract into the body of the ship, but I noticed after it was up away that they were gone.
You mentioned that on each end of the ship, there was a bulkhead, which you did not see. You mentioned that all the walls are transparent. How come that you didn't see into this compartment?
Straight ahead or straight back to each end of the ship, it wasn't transparent. You could look up or down underneath this bulkhead or over this bulkhead and could look out, but straight through you could not see into this, each end of this ship, with these rooms were approximately 25 feet long.
Were there any doors into this compartment?
There probably was, but I couldn't see it. It looked like just a straight piece of metal, same as the outside of the ship where the door was.
The outside entrance to the ship, the door, it seemed to disappear. Do you have any theory or any reason for this?
The door, you mean?
Yes.
I don't know where this, how they could fit it so close, but it seemed when the door was closed, it just completely fused in with the side of the ship. There are no seams or anything.
Now, regarding your activities since this second experience and your appearances at Davenport, Iowa, Tipton, Toledo, Ohio, and here at Kalamazoo, Michigan, how do you feel about the public reaction of various persons around Kearney, Nebraska, and at other places, the people that you have met that have this interest in this flying saucer field? What is your present feeling towards other people in general?
Well, I think the people around this eastern part of the state have just been wonderful. Although I did have a lot of friends in Kearney, Nebraska, even in fact when I came back out of the hospital, there was a lot of friends around there, even some of the officials that worked against me, they would talk to me and be very friendly. The people in the eastern part of the state especially were friendly to me.
Now, regarding this situation that developed in Kearney, Nebraska, is there any legal action underway or developing to try to clear up this matter and to try to clear up your name? Also, have you ever received or located that lost mail, and do you have any plans for trying to locate that mail that was not delivered to you?
No, I have never received the mail, and I haven't talked to my lawyer about it, whether I'm going to try and proceed to get this mail or not. There is a legal action going on now. My lawyers in Omaha, Nebraska are working on that now. When it will take place, I really don't know for sure.
What are your present plans toward trying to clear your name and bring the reality of this space visit to the people of America?
I think a lot of it will help traveling with the major a-hole, and the people will at least know that I'm out of the hospital and hear the truth, the first-hand, and not from newspapers or other tapes that have been changed a lot.
Major, for the benefit of our listening audience, I wonder if you would tell them something of your background, how it is that you have the title of Major, and in other words, what qualifies you as a credible observer and as a speaker on the topic?
Yes, I'll be happy to cover that. I was born in the state of Washington. I have lived mostly on the west coast of the United States. I went into military service after being employed on the west coast of the Longbell Lumber Company in Longview, Washington, and the Longbell Fire Department and the City Fire Department there at Longview, and after the usual educational background, including business college. I went into the service in 1937. That was the Washington National Guard at that time. I helped organize a unit and trained with a unit that later went to Alaska. We were sent into foreign service prior to Pearl Harbor after training at Kelso, Washington and Fort Lewis, Washington. I served in Alaska for approximately a year, and then I was sent to the eastern coast for training in the Officer Candidate School. I had been the first sergeant of the unit in Alaska. I received a commission as a second lieutenant at Camp Davis, North Carolina, the Officer Candidate School. I went to Fort Bliss, Texas, and helped train another unit that was bound for service in the European theater. This was a unit that later landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day, and I was with the unit. I was designated as the intelligence officer of the unit, and my specialty was Army Combat Intelligence. My unit, after full training in assault landings and assault warfare, was shipped to England for additional training, and we landed in support of the 16th Infantry
of the 1st Infantry Division on Omaha Beach on D-Day. We participated in all campaigns of the European theater, and I advanced in grade until I finally reached the grade of major at the end of the hostilities due to my record. I have been awarded the Bronze Star Medal for exceptional meritorious service and the Purple Heart and other campaign medals and Arrowhead, etc., for the Salt Landing. I have served an entire period of 16 years in active and reserve duty. I am working now in a civilian capacity, which I felt was more appropriate because of the fact that I am carrying on a type of an educational campaign that is not necessarily the desire or the attitude or belief of the armed services, and I'm doing this as a civilian. I have seen a spaceship myself in the state of California on the night of May 11, 1957, and I know that these spaceships are real. I felt the need, because of the gravity of the situation and the holding back of this information from the public and my knowledge of the subject, that I should take an active part in this educational program. So I went to Washington, D.C. in May of 1957, and I have been in that part of the nation since that time, carrying on an educational program, and I developed a group known as Washington Saucer Intelligence, a group of civilians in the Washington area, in the states of Maryland and Virginia. We have been very active, and I have tried to support all people, all groups that are trying to do something in a constructive way. I don't have much interest or stock in the negativity that comes from some directions and some people, where people seem to want to destroy the character and the very existence of some people that are researching in this field. I believe that there is a reason for constructive work, and I support the constructive work.